You see, kid, I got to tell you something. I've interviewed 20-something people for this job. You are the least qualified. But you almost convinced me you knew what you were doing. He said, so I'm going to give you the chance.
This is the Injury Pros Podcast, a serious and engaging look at how injuries impact us, the professionals behind it, and the strength it takes to represent the injured. We break down litigation strategy, medical expertise, real-life questions and stories, and the evolving landscape of where our industry is headed next. The Injury Pros starts now.
I want to welcome everybody back to the Injury Pros Podcast. I am privileged to be joined today by John Cordisco. John is the founding partner at Cordisco & Sale and has over 40 years of legal experience throughout Bucks County. Also has a prominent history as a public figure throughout the county and has a history both on the House of Representatives and the school board and has done a lot of things charitably within our community to make a difference. John, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, Alex.
So the direction and topic today is kind of defining success and how John is looking at success and the legal field nowadays, how it's changed over the years, kind of how he defines it. And just a little bit of his background and how that background has impacted how he looks at things, how he looks at the law, how he looks at personal injury law, and just those careers in the legal industry going forward.
Okay.
So, John, I want to start, you know, you had sent me a video last week that we talked quite a bit about. It was a story about a master pianist and also a young female pianist. And I want to give you a chance to kind of share a little bit about that story, kind of your take on it and kind of how it stood out to you and why you kind of want to tie it into what we're going to talk about today.
It was a regular morning. I just was, you know, woke up and had my espresso and my biscotti, and I had to go check my messages, and all of a sudden this video popped up, and I was curious, and I said, let me just start playing it, and I couldn't stop. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at the clock on the oven across the room and realized, you know, I better get moving pretty quickly or I'm going to be late for my first meeting. But I couldn't stop. It was an incredible story. A story I actually sent to my granddaughters and my grandsons just as a, give them a sense of motivation as to an instance of life itself, a message was within this episode that I think was worth sharing. It was a story about a young Asian woman who lost her parents early in life, and she had a little brother, and her story of raising her little brother, but also in finding this keyboard in a thrift shop when she was about 7 years old, and she was just drawn to it, and she practiced on it every day, hours at a time. And that was her kind of escape to some level from dealing with the difficulties of trying to raise a younger brother and keep a roof over their head and still be able to follow her passion, which was to play the piano. So she had written a composition, and there was a master pianist who was, I guess at this point, probably the most notable pianist in the world. Sold out concerts, very wealthy, prominent individual. So she saved up everything that she could, bought a bus ticket and a ticket to a show in hoping that he would take a look at her composition. She stood by the door to which she expected him to exit from the show. And as he came forward, she stopped him and introduced herself and said she had written this composition. Would he be so kind to take a look at it? And he basically responded by saying, you know how many people come up to me with compositions that are poorly written in hopes that, you know, I'm going to say something positive about it. And, I don't have time. I have people waiting for me to go to dinner. And there was another woman there who was a big supporter of his and obviously very wealthy. He was like basically saying in a nice way, come on, young lady, move on. You know, we have more important things to do. We have to go to dinner. This is an important man. and don't waste his time. But she was insistent. And she basically said, you know, just give me the chance. And he saw something in her that he recognized within himself. And he said, I'll give you 5 minutes. So she went off through the Steinway that he had played during his concert and began as he looked at his cell phone, clocked it for 5 minutes, was hoping this would move very quickly. And he was surprised, not because she was technically sound, because she was not. But what he saw within her was this raw passion, her ability to let the music speak to the audience. The composition was about the struggles of her life, the beginning, the middle, the end of the small concert that she performed, were different stages of her life that he, not knowing her, felt. And when she completed, he said, I haven't taken on a student in years, but I'm willing to take you on if you're willing to commit yourself. She was flabbergasted. She agreed. So that required her to basically put 4 hours, a minimum, a day in her practice, take care of her brother, and still provide enough financial resources so that they could survive. It's passion and a commitment. And she continually improved. He was hard on her, but then also rewarded her in a positive comment when it was deserved. At one point, there was an international contest for young pianists, and he suggested that she, apply. And she was excited for about a second and then said, I can't compete with these other students. And some of them are from Juilliard and various, incredible universities that and studied all their life music. And he agreed. He said, you probably are not as technically proficient as them, but what you have is a raw talent to have your music speak, and which they will not have, and that's your edge. So we'll continue to practice. She filed the application and waited. And the night came when it was her turn to time to perform. Her brother was in the audience, and so was the maestro. And she was very nervous. She went out and began. After first phase of her second there, she heard a few applause as a background. She thought maybe it was probably her brother. And he made the one statement to her, play your heart out. Put everything you have into your music. Don't worry about the technical elements. She did that. And when she completed, there was silence. Within seconds, there was a small applause that got louder and louder. And she received a standing ovation, and she won the contest. And from there, she decided that she was going to continue to work, and she got offers and to go to their various universities, as well as to be able to play. And her dream was to have a foundation where she can help others to get the opportunity that she got because of what the maestro saw in her. He then said to her, I'm going to make you a deal. And the deal would be such that I will continue to work with you to perfect you technically, if you continue to work with me to compose again, because I forgot why I got into music in the first place. The music stopped talking. I got more proficient. In doing that, I lost part of my soul in the process. I want to regain that again. And people around him were very skeptical, saying, why do you want to do this now? You're at the top of your game, you know, financially rewarding. It wasn't rewarding to him. And therefore he went forward. And with his compositions, he was taking risk, doing something outside the box that he was afraid to do all these years. So he got that confidence from watching her. That was the exchange. So it's a beautiful story. But it allowed me to relate back to my own personal story and why I ended up doing what I have done and where I am today. It allowed me to reflect on that and what I believe should be important to attorneys, especially young attorneys today.
So let's elaborate on that a little bit, John. Obviously, a beautiful story. Tell it extremely well. And there's a mirror there for you, right? Really, maybe on both ends of this, right? So the maestro in this story, which is probably closer to kind of where you are now in your career, but even this young woman, you know, you have some life stories that reflect and kind of relate back to her similarly, right? And how you got there and how you had a passion for what you were doing at a young age, made sacrifices, and, you know, had people along the way like the maestro that saw your passion, saw your efforts, and helped you to lift you up to where you were. So tell us a little bit about kind of how you got started, how your career got started, and kind of how that mirrors the story you just shared.
Well, I mean, it goes back a while. I was elected to the school board. I think I ran for the school board. I was 21 years old. I was elected. I was 22. And my town, Bristol Borough, and there were 9 candidates running for 3 positions. And it was my first real experience in politics. I had gone to Jimmy Carter's inauguration with some older men from Bristol. And I was, I guess, bitten by the bug there. And, and I said I wanted to do something. And since I was just completing my degree in education, I thought school board would be a natural fit. And thanks to the people in Bristol and family and friends, I was elected. It was a great experience. The dedication of the other 8 members was impressive to a young 22-year-old. They took their tasks very seriously and were very compassionate. As a result, I said, you know, I want to continue to do this maybe in a different area. And at that time, the state representative was Ted Berlin. He decided he was going to retire, and there was a vacancy. So I ran the same, you know, young guys around. We thought this was, you know, fun. We enjoyed it, the whole process. Fortunately, I lost by 51 votes. And that's when Rocky was at its highlight, the movie, and it, you know, there's going to be Rocky 2. And then I kind of picked up on that and just said, you know, there will be a round 2. And I ran again and was successful. And I still remember being sworn in, and my grandfather, who was one of the most beautiful men I ever met in my life, maybe they came here when he was 14, couldn't speak English. His father was a tenant farmer in Italy, and he was the oldest. He was going to bring him over one at a time. And his father was a foreman on the railroad of Canada. And he unfortunately died of pneumonia within the first year there. So there's my grandfather, a young guy, nowhere to go. Ends up in Florence, New Jersey with relatives. Still doesn't speak a word of English, and worked in a pipe foundry within Florence, and rented a room in the home next to where my grandmother lived. That's how we met her.
Mm-hmm.
Cute little story. They said they used to talk in the cellar through a little opening when they were younger. And he worked 40 plus years and never once ever complained about anything as his hardship. These things I only learned later in life, and was probably the beginning of the encouragement. He loved this country, and he said, you know, you could be president if you want to be. If you're determined, you work hard, nothing is impossible in this country. That was the seed that was planted. Then, boom, there I was, looking like Michael J. Fox, looking 14 years old, and he's sitting next to me with every newspaper focused on him, because you're not supposed to have had anybody see in there where the members were there. And I still have this picture to this day, and he's looking around in awe because of the ornate element of the chamber. And I'm looking with, you know, taking the oath with my right hand up, looking scared to death. They don't give you any kind of indication of what the job's going to entail when you run for office. Maybe they should.
Especially not at that age.
Yeah.
Because people have a little experience before they get into it, right?
And the leadership there, in particular, Jim Mandarino, took a liking to me, kind of like a father-son relationship. And, you know, he kept me close to him. And I guess he saw something I didn't see in myself. You know, I didn't know that there was a structure within the chamber. I just was a young man determined to get the things that I said I would do accomplished. One of them was a barrier across Route 13. 10 people had died by hydroplaning. And now you see them throughout the state of Pennsylvania. But the first barrier was placed on Route 13 in Levittown. So that was the beginning. And because of my determination in negotiating that project into the capital budget, which I didn't realize weren't supposed to do individually, but I did it with the governor's office and was successful. You know, in one sense, you know, Jim Mandarino would look at me like a kid that's always getting in trouble. And in the next moment, he'd be looking at me with a smile of a father's pride of your son doing something that was good for others. Next thing I know, he calls me over and he says to me, I need to talk to you. And I said, well, I didn't do it. He goes, well, maybe today you didn't do it. Because he knew it, that mischievous nature that I had. There may be something up. He said, you should go to law school. And at that time, I was just my first, you know, then my first term. You know, at this point, I'm married. You know, I have two children. One on the way, and I'm saying, I got a real job. I don't really want to leave here. And he said, son, let me explain this to you. There really is no future here. Do what you came to do for the people you represent. That's where you were elected. Many here stay here. Maybe some of them do some things and some of them just go for the ride. But it's not a place you want to stay and make a career out of. And I said to him, well, you're an attorney. Why aren't you practicing law? He said, well, the Still Mill in Manessa closed. And there's not a lot, you know, of opportunity in Manessa. Mm-hmm. So I decided to run for office. I wasn't happy about the idea, but he was pretty determined. Mm-hmm. And he said, you have a meeting in the morning with the president of the law school, Peter Liacouris, try not to screw it up.
It must have worked out.
Yeah, well, he said,
40 years later, you're still a lawyer, right?
That's true. He said, try listening and try not to talk too much. So I ended up actually developing a real friendship with President Liacouris throughout life. And I agreed to do it. I took the LSATs and scored high enough that, you know, I could be accepted into Temple Law. But I would have to, Monday through Thursday, get up in the morning, really early, drive 2 hours to Harrisburg, sit through session, drive to Philadelphia, sit in 3 hours of class, and then drive back to Bristol 3 to 4 days a week. Well, unfortunately, within about 6 months of that program, I was exhausted and found myself, you know, riding the guardrail along the turnpike, which was a scary thought.
Yeah.
And realized maybe there's a better route to do this. And, some of the younger reps there said to me, you know, why don't you drive the Bristol to Philadelphia, take the train. Some of us do that.
Mm-hmm.
And at least you can get your studies done and things of that nature, and you will be exhausted. And so for the remainder of the 3 years, because it was a 4-year course, I did just that. And lo and behold, I studied very hard for the bar and passed. And woke up and was now licensed to practice law in the state of Pennsylvania.
And as John has omitted through some of this, you worked full time from the time you were a junior in high school till then, right? You were always worked night, evening shifts, later shifts, second shifts.
Yeah.
To cover all the costs of this and all the things that you needed to do. So,
well,
you're kind enough to leave that out, but I know the work ethic you have and, you know, 10 years of school and work and to pay for it at the same time, right? So you just always had a work ethic similar, going back to the story we shared at the beginning, you know, this young woman, just the passion and work ethic she's had while also taking care of a family, while also investing in her passion at the same time. I think a lot of the reason that story resonates with you, because a lot of what you shared with us from your time in high school up until you finished law school was a similar path.
Well, I think it was a great advantage to me as a lawyer to have experienced those trials and tribulations associated with life. You know, my father worked at Philco Ford and then Ford Aeronautics. And, he'd wake up in the morning, I still remember, because he would drop me off at St. Anne's Church. I was an altar boy, and sometimes I had to serve 6:30 Mass. And he was already on the road with three other people that were relying upon him to take them to work every day. In the 40 years that he worked, he never took one sick day because he knew three other people were dependent upon him. But with five kids in the household, my mom and dad worked very hard. You know, my dad was blue collar worker. My mom worked in evenings in the local bakery. So there wasn't a lot of extra money laying around. You know, if you wanted the better things, you had to work for them. In the summer, you know, I still remember working in a bakery, long hours. I think I was paid $1.65 an hour, but I worked enough hours. In 1 week, I worked, believe it or not, this is crazy, but think of it, like 15, 16 years old. Somewhere close to 70 hours, enough to buy new sneakers because I wanted to have the cool new sneakers.
For sure.
Right. And, that's the path that went, you know, and my father could not afford, the tuition. I, at that point in time, was going to Bishop Egan High School. There weren't a lot of options. It was either find a way to pay for this yourself, or you could attend. And I didn't want to quit. So I was able to get a job at a place called Keystone Lighting. A lot of nice people there. And I worked 4 to 12. But no one knew that I had to work to pay the tuition because I didn't want to feel the shame of quote-unquote being poor.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bus would drop me off right there at the corner, kind of a green lane there, Route 13, and I would take my jacket that I had to wear for school off and put in a little gym bag and, you know, get ready to go to work 4 to 12. And the guys that were working that 4-to-12 shift were really respectful of the fact that I had a purpose for doing what I was doing, because it didn't make sense to them. You're still in high school and you're working in a factory. So they gave me the easiest jobs. Like, you know, one time it was they had to stand there and just pull a handle down and create a rivet all night. And there was no quota, but it gave me time, you know, lunchtime and so forth to get some of my schoolwork done. It really wasn't till one of my good friends, Bill Burns, nominated me to the Wall of Fame for the class of 73 that I got exposed for working at such a young age to pay for tuition that my family could afford. And it actually turned into a proud moment, you know. And that's how, you know, the guys in my class, which great bunch of guys, you know, looked at it. They didn't see shame. They saw determination.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I went from there and didn't have enough money to really go to any university. So I went to Bucks and got a great education at Bucks. Once again.
Bucks Community College, John.
Bucks Community, yeah. Bucks County Community College. Once again, I'm back off to work. And at this time, you know, I'm married and we respect child, and I got a job at National CAM, which is actually one of the jobs that many people vied for down by the mill because they paid so well. And I remember going in and was being interviewed by the plant manager, and he said, "Are you related to this another Cordisco?" And I said, "Oh yeah, he's my cousin." I just figured we're all related. It's not like Smith, right? So it wasn't a real lie, maybe a white lie, but it wasn't much. And ironically, they then asked him, and he said, "Oh yeah, he's my cousin." So I got the job. It was only like 3 months later when both of us went to, like, I was checking in and he was checking out that we went to get our cards. And we introduced each other to each other. Said, "Oh, okay. So yeah. You're the Cordisco." Yeah. So, you know, that got me through, and I ended up going to Rider and, you know, getting my bachelor's and an education. Taught for 6 months at Ben Salem, but there wasn't really opportunity. And I got this job at Allentown Caging. And I had no idea what the job entailed. It was recommended to me by a friend. Got interviewed, and the guy was a real character that was running the company. He said, "Kid, I got to tell you something. I've interviewed 20-something people for this job. You are the least qualified, but you almost convinced me you knew what you were doing." He said, "So I'm going to give you the chance." And Bristol, Allentown, New Jersey, and I was pretty decent at math, so most of it was just determining, you know, purchase orders on steel and things of that nature. So I was okay. And he wanted me to continue with the company, you know, expanding. But I was also on the school board at that time and was running for the state house. At which point, I never thought that my election would reach Allentown, New Jersey. But unfortunately, I walked in the office that morning after the election, and there was a newspaper of the Trenton Times showing my mug on the front page as winning.
Your boss is staring at it. Hey, what's going on?
Right. Winning the primary, he goes, "Did you forget to tell me something?" And I said, "I didn't know what was going to happen, and I really need this job." And he said, "Unfortunately, son, I can't keep you because if you win in November, you know, all this time that I'll put in to you and the company at the company's expense really won't work out." So he said, "But I'll lay you off and see what you can do." So I didn't really like that idea of being laid off. So I applied for another job at Ronson Aviation and didn't pay much. I still remember Mr. D'Amico was the gentleman that interviewed me, and He had already lost two legs to diabetes. And, I was kind of taken back, coming into the interview as to, this guy seems pretty happy in what he's doing. And it was very pleasant to me. And not thinking it was hardship, he said to me, "Kid, you are way overqualified for this job. All you have to do is, keep tabs on the hours on the planes and helicopters. It's really, and it doesn't pay much. You're going to get paid about $160, a week." I said, "It's something. I just need this for 3 months. Mm-hmm. Can you, maybe 4 months?" And he said, "You know what, kid? I see in you a determination, and I'm going to give you the chance. It's not going to cost us anything. I'm sure you'll do a good job." He later passed on. I will never forget him for giving me that opportunity. Next thing I knew, as I said, I won the election in November and off to the State House.
So before obviously, we're mainly here because you're a legal lawyer experience, right? But just you listening to the opportunities that you had, all these various opportunities you had before you even got to that point. And it's interesting kind of tying back all the stories you have of these individuals over these years, right? Yeah. These different places that, even what may seem like little gestures, you remember to this day, many years later that were important to you.
Very true. And I'll tell you, I think one of the most memorable was my first real test of character. While working at National Can, there were times where, you got laid off because it was kind of ran seasonal because you made lids to soda cans. And so we manufactured soda cans. So obviously, as you got into the summer months, you're going to be busier. You worked a lot of overtime, and then it really slowed down during the winter months. And at that time, there was me and my wife, Sharon, and my oldest daughter, Kelly. And we're living with my siblings and my parents. So there were 9 of us in a 3-bedroom house. So my father said, "You have to do something. You have to contribute somewhere. I don't have enough in the way of financial resources to be able to provide for all of you." And I thought of my options, and the only thing that really I would have qualified for because of the nature of the setting was for maybe food stamps or something of that nature. So I kind of swallowed my pride and, went to the office and stood in line with other folks who, none of them really seemed to want to be there either. And, for that short window, maybe less than 6 months, maybe 4 months there, we received the food stamps until I went back to work. And I remember in my first term, the issue of welfare reform came up. And it was pretty heated conversation between the membership. I watched, I listened. And there was a characterization by another member of the House of the people who abused the system, and how this system is corrupt, doesn't work. Yeah. And I thought of myself as that person in that line with those other people that were there. As I said, many of them didn't want to be there, but for something beyond their control, that's where they ended up. So as I heard it go on, I became angrier, but was afraid. I didn't want any of the other House members to know that I was at one time in that welfare line. Mm-hmm. The same kind of mindset that I had later as it relates to having to work to pay your tuition. So I thought about it. Something inside me, maybe it was, my religious schooling, being around people with character, I can't tell you. Something stirred me enough to go to the microphone. And people were looking at me perplexed, like, we're from Bucks County. What do you have to say about welfare reform? And you're like, you know, at this point, maybe 25 years old. And the speaker, K. Leroy Irving, very brilliant man, good person, said to me, does the young man from Bucks County have something to say about this issue? And I said, I'd like to interrogate the man from Delaware County. And the speaker looked at me and was perplexed as to where I was going with this. And he said, okay. So the representative from Delaware County stood and I said, I want you to look at my face. And he looks even more perplexed than the speaker, but it's got everybody's attention now in the house. And tell me what you see. He said, I see the man from Bucks County. And I said, I want you to look again and tell me what you see. And the man from Delaware said, I don't understand the question. It's a simple question. Look at my face and what do you see? And he stood there in silence without an answer because he obviously didn't understand the question. I said, well, this is a face of a person who stood in a welfare line. Not because he wanted to, but because his family needed him to. So that required swallowing my pride and doing what I thought was best for my family. So before you cast judgment on people who are applying for this program, you should take the time to look at their faces. I sat down and there was dead silence in the house. I didn't know what to think. I don't know whether it was a good thing I did, crazy thing I did. Not so quite sure.
Somewhere in the middle.
Right? Somewhere in the middle. But like the story of the young girl, there was a few claps, a few more louder claps. And the House of Representatives gave me a standing ovation. It was my first trip to the microphone. And I think it was at that point that Jim Mandarino thought in his mind, maybe this kid would be a pretty good lawyer.
That's a good segue. So you obviously you have this extensive background before you even became a lawyer. So obviously you go to law school, you finish up law school, you take a lot of this experience from all these other areas of life and you bring it with you, right? And we always, you know, we kind of, those that know you know how relatable you are to people, right? Human beings, right? So you're a lawyer, there's an element of that, but there's also, you know, understanding people. So tell me a little bit about like how you got started in legal, how that's turned into a 40-year career, personal injury law, and kind of how you look at how your background experience ties into how you've taken your law career from there.
Well, ironically enough, I spent 3 terms there. And once I, you know, passed the bar, wanted to practice law. And I was taking Jim Mandarino's advice. I reached that same point after the 3 terms I had accomplished what I set out to do. Was very fortunate in the committee assignments that I was giving. I was spokesman for labor, chairman of Veterans Homes, responsible for the legislation constructing the 3rd one, testified before Congress as to why the state should oversee the veterans' homes that are there currently rather than the federal government. Kind of funny story because I, you know, testified it was local, it was in Delaware County. The congressman there was on the committee, and Sonny Montgomery was the chairman. I still looked about 14, 15 years old, and I was asked to testify as the chairman of the committee. as to why that should be. So there was a congressional panel. I go to the microphone. I guess nobody bothered to say how old I was. And Sonny Montgomery just looked at me and said, "Son, just don't take this the wrong way, but I really believe I have shoes older than you." He said, "I don't know what you're going to say, but I'm very, very interested in hearing it." And at the end, it was kind of one of those moments that he looked at me and said, "Your parents would have been proud of you today." I said, "Thanks." But, you know, once again, a great experience. And like I said, those experiences were priceless. They appointed me to the Judiciary Committee. There I am on the Judiciary Committee as a law student, you know, hearing what's going on as it relates to, like, you know, the codification of evidence when I'm in an evidence class trying to listen and understand. And that was impactful. But leaving and then going back to my hometown of Bristol and thinking, you know what? You know, I had all these people who were so nice to me and voted for me. You know, I should be able to really build a practice of law pretty quickly. Well, I was wrong. Dead wrong. I actually ended up taking a position with two attorneys from Bristol, two good guys. But they said, "Listen, John, we'll hire you, but we can only pay you X and we expect you to produce Y." Well, X happened to be about a third of what I was making in the house. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the first year, I think I had to produce like 50 grand. I think I produced like 44. And they said, "You know, you're 6,000 short." I go, "Why? Well, I've only got paid 25,000. I'm not giving you $6,000 back."
Yeah.
And I understood their position, but like I said, sometimes you're fortunate to be at the right place at the right time with the right opportunity, and someone sees something in you that you don't necessarily see in yourself. And that person was a fellow by the name of Joe Steferi, who happened to be the manager over at John's Auto, which, you know, was John Beck's facility. Had been there forever. And a good friend of them, who a woman that was actually president of the school board in Bristol Township, who gave me a position as a solicitor there, even though, you know, I wasn't really familiar with the law, but I did serve as a school board member and found my way through that. But she recommended me to the business. And this is how I get moved from doing kind of municipal law to personal injury, because Joe was a very charismatic guy and really took care of people. They trusted him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, "Listen, I get people that come in, they're looking for attorneys. Do you mind if I refer them to you?" And I said, "Why, you know, ethically, you know, I can't compensate you for that." He goes, "I'm not looking for a compensation job." So when he said that, I said, "Obviously, okay, but, well, you know, I really haven't done a lot in the way of personal injury. But, you know, one of the other attorneys that was in the office at the time, Billy Salerno, who, you know, I've known since the days of grade school, you know, knew he had done some work with the insurance company and was doing, you know, personal injury on the plaintiff's side. So there was some guidance that I got there. And I said to him, you know, this, I don't know whether lack of experience is going to, you know, be a problem. He goes, "John, I trust you. I know you'll find the right answers. You'll be okay." I still remember those words. "I trust you." That was the motivator. I would not let him down. So I went to every seminar I could find, talked to other attorneys, and within a two-year window or less, you know, a little over 2 years, opened up my own practice in Bristol. And with a friend of mine who still practices with me today, we were both
Kevin,
in law
school. Kevin Bradway.
Kevin Bradway. We were in law school together.
Mm-hmm.
He took the best notes. I took no notes because I had struggled just to pay attention. There were times that I would disrupt every, you know, his ability to take notes so that we could just take a break. But, you know, we studied together for law exams because we were in mostly same classes. And we had our secretary, Madeline Bryson, who followed me throughout that career. She was just great with people. She knew what she was doing. We then added Mary Hayden, which was, you know, another secretary that once again stayed with me for, you know, the early part of my career. Probably would not have had the success that I had at that time without him. And from there, it kind of grew. There's just people, we never spent any money on marketing or social media. It wasn't a thing of that day that we just run around with, you know.
Yeah, it's different now today.
Cell phones, you know, that all that data. So by word of mouth, just by word of mouth, and by Joe Staffieri, anyone who came into that shop who needed an attorney from an accident or a bad situation, he called me immediately. In the beginning, it was kind of funny. He'd say, I don't know if he's available. Let me try. Meanwhile, I was sitting by my desk hoping somebody would call. And that's how it all started out. And I'm very, very grateful for those to those people.
And I think that's, you know, that's important in law firms today. But I, you know, talking about how when you started practicing and grew your personal injury practice on your own to where it is now, obviously very different. But even it's important today. But that that trust and that word of mouth referral and the people in your community and that center of influence was so important at that time before, because even the rules and regulations with advertising with attorneys was different back then. You were really limited on what you could do. So you had to build a practice back then. You had to have those type of relationships, right?
Yeah, I think that my life experiences really were pivotal in allowing me the success that I had early on, because in law and personal injury in particular, you're telling that person's story. So I always say this to other attorneys that, you know, the key is that you have to marry that pain. It's not pleasant. Something you'd rather not think of. You have your own issues to deal with, your own children, your own family, your own finances. But now you have to take on somebody else's struggle. And they are relying upon you, solely upon you, to get them through maybe one of the worst times of their lives. And if you're not willing to do that, you're not going to be a very successful storyteller, because you can't allow people, or people won't be able to relate to the situation unless you have that passion. Back to that same story from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
You know, that one young girl who had a unique talent, okay, of being able to express her life journey through music. It's the same task. You have to convince people who do not know that individual, then share in that suffering, that this person was seriously injured and is in a bad place. And financially, this could help them get through that difficult time. Or, if anything else, give them a sense of justice so that maybe this doesn't occur again.
John, you know, you've been doing this for years. You've probably sat down with thousands and thousands of clients, right? Different walks of life. Like, talk a little bit about, like, relatability, meeting with clients. Like, everybody's a little bit different. They come from different walks of life. They have different values, they have different beliefs, families, things like that. Like, how do you find, like, a successful client interaction? Like, how do you look at that? Do you have to put yourself in their shoes? Do you have to kind of understand who they are? Like, how do you find that? How do you work through that with a new client when you're meeting with them?
I think it just comes naturally because you're there to listen to their situation. And as they begin to speak, there'll be words that will be put forth that will kind of ring a bell in your mind and take you back to a place similar, maybe not exact, you know, but something that you can at least begin to relate to. And you have to be a very good listener. You know, you really have to take the time and have the patience to fully understand that suffering that's going on. You know, I've had clients come in and say, you know, I really wasn't hurt that bad. You know, what do you think my case is worth? And I have to clearly explain that I can't take your case. You should be very thankful that you're not hurt. I've been asked to represent people who are really hurt, and I just cannot put forth someone in a situation that I know is false. So, you know, you always get asked that question, or what is my case worth? And you have to explain to people, I don't know, because I'm just, this is the beginning of the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you that. And I don't think that should be the focus. My role here is to make sure that you get the right treatment. So, you know, I'm looking at these, their injuries, and looking what's going on and seeing where you can get help. You know, what does your policy say? You know, what are the facts of the accident? And, you know, breaking it down to its finest elements and saying, okay, what does this story say? And I think the saddest part about being a personal injury lawyer for me is I can never give them back what they lost. It's a hollow victory. I may be able to help them through some of the financial issues that person will be facing, some of the medical issues that person may be facing. But I can't give them back the life they lost, parts of their life that they lost. So it's for that one moment, you feel you accomplished what you were set out to do, but it fades very quickly.
You know, obviously, personal injury law is a unique industry for a lot of the reasons you just shared. There's challenges of being a personal injury lawyer. You've been in this industry for so long that you've probably seen a lot of change from where it was when you started and maybe really where it is today. You know, I make the case it's a much more business-oriented, analytical, numbers-driven industry maybe than it's been in the past, especially if you're trying to grow as a law firm. There's a lot more large-scale law firms out there in personal injury. What do you see, you know, you can go good or bad or maybe a combination of both. What have you seen is the changes in the industry that have you've noticed the most, have impacted you the most, and kind of want to point out?
I think it's just the personal touch. You know, today you can travel down 95 and see one billboard after another with one gimmick after another that says nothing about the firm itself. Except I saw one that probably made the most sense. It says, you know, you shouldn't judge a lawyer or pick a lawyer from a billboard.
So a billboard said you shouldn't pick a lawyer from
right.
a lawyer. Great.
Yeah. Which I thought was very clever, but very true. You know, you see it as far as, you know, television commercials that, you know, once again, you know, there's a gimmick attached to it. I think in some ways, it's minimizes the responsibility and expectation and trust that you're trying to put forth to the person who's in that condition. Unfortunately, I guess marketing in the United States is something that's commonplace and it's very effective. I don't know if it's as effective to the people that actually, in the end of the day, need it, but you actually have billboards now with attorneys that don't even practice law to just get the referral, send it to an attorney, and then get a referral fee. So I think today, more than ever, you really need to ask real questions to the lawyer you're going to hire as it relates to personal injury. What's your experience? How many cases have you handled? What type of cases have you handled? And how long have you been doing this? And why don't you tell me a little about yourself? Why did you get into the practice of the law, in particular, personal injury? Let them tell you their story before you give them yours.
So just to add on to what you're saying there is obviously hyper-competitive industry for marketing. We know that some law firms are more skilled at marketing, talented at marketing, but maybe don't have the best attorneys. So the challenge for the consumer, person that's hurt, is the firms that you're finding within the marketing aren't necessarily the best fit for you as the attorney, right? So that's a challenge. So talk a little bit more about, you know, however you find a firm, you should interview your attorney. You should ask the right questions. What should you be looking for? Like, what are the key elements that you should be looking for before you hire? If I'm going to pick an attorney, maybe give me three things I should key in on that before I make an hire on a personal injury lawyer I should be looking for.
Well, you know, today with the amount of data that's available, I would probably look at the type of reviews, not how many reviews. Look at the type of reviews. You know, one of the first reviews that I received from a client, it was a father who lost his young 23 years old at the time, son, in a terrible car accident after they were leaving one of the local bars there, sports bars. And, you know, we still to this day don't know exactly what happened under the circumstances. So they didn't find the young boys till the next day. Could have been a deer that unfortunately dashed down in front of the car, whatever the case would be. And when I met with the dad, I could see the pain and the agony. Some was a teacher or was a coach. Everything that, you know, he would want a son to be, the proud dad. And he could see the love that was there. I mean, just in the interview, I was heartbroken. I said, I don't know what's going to happen because the law wasn't on our side under these circumstances. So I got creative and I thought, you know, maybe this would be a way to make new law, because it should be, because under current law, if you have to prove that a bartender or maid served you knowing that you're basically intoxicated in order to be successful for a dram shop action. In this case, there was a way that was created to get around that, you know, intent of that statute, whereby the one sober person went up to the bar and bought all the drinks and bought them all back to the people who should not have had as many drinks as they had.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that, you know, I went, I made my research, came up with a theory under common law and presented that and was successful. But what the father wrote was a greater reward than any fee that I received from that case, because I don't even know what that was. He said, John was a good lawyer, and he took this case where others had said there was none. But that's not what I thought was what John provided. He wrote, I would never have gotten through this period of time in my life if John wasn't with me the whole way. That was the reward that was worth doing what I was doing and allowed me to continue to do what I do. When I was a young lawyer, an older lawyer once said to me, you know, work hard, do what's right, focus on your client, the money will follow. Today, I believe that with the ability to use all the marketing tools available to you, that somewhere along the line, some of that gets lost. You know, it seems the money's the driver rather than the client. And that's sad. I was nominated by the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and affirmed by the Supreme Court to serve on the disciplinary board. I served for 6 years on the board, served as vice chair, and actually adjudicated some of the cases that came before me where attorneys appealed a decision that was made by the board or recommendation that was made by the hearing board. And you see, there are, like in any industry, there are people that have issues, The disciplinary board was very good at trying to find, okay, what was the cause of this person's action? Usually it's a commingling of money where you take the client's money and mix it with yours. And there's really no defense to that one. But let's just say you went through a bad situation and developed an alcoholic problem or a drug problem. They will provide assistance, and their attorneys that will volunteer themselves to, oversee and manage your practice to ensure that, you're able to, not be drawn into that addiction and being able to, represent people responsibly.
And I think, you mentioned, John, your experience at the disciplinary board. I mean, perfect example, when you're looking for an attorney that, that something that separates them from a standpoint of experience and their capability, like an attorney that's been on the disciplinary board, like you've seen, that's the highest regard you can put on a local attorney is having served in that role.
I was very honored to serve in the role and honored to serve with the people that were serving with me at that time. Everybody took that role very seriously. We're trying to make it better so that people are protected against attorneys that should not be practicing law. But it's not a catch-all. You're going to have to do a little bit of your own, research. You have attorneys that will maybe do some divorces, they'll do some bankruptcies, and then they'll do some personal injury. It's not to say that they're not capable of doing it, but I don't know whether that's the best decision on your part. You're right. I probably have represented over 2,000 people. But this is all I do. If anybody calls me and wants me to do a will or something, I refer them to a very capable person. And I'll say if they need me for anything, I'm always there. I've maintained that even when their case ends here that says, I'm not one and done. If something happens in your life and it's a legal question, feel free to call me. I'm be in the same office. You'll have my cell phone. Don't hesitate. And people have done that. I had a sheet metal worker just recently who lost his mom in a terrible situation. And he had bought a warranty on his BMW, and they were giving a runaround. And he said, John said, I can call him. He called me. I got it. Sent a letter over to the warranty company and told them what the consequences were going to be that if he doesn't get his warranty. And to the dealership who sold it, who basically were telling him, we have nothing to do. We sold it, and that was the end of it. When they got that letter, they realized, well, maybe we should call the warranty company. And he came over to my office, dropped off a copy of the letter that he got saying, that warranty is in place, you're covered. we apologize for the issues associated with it. And she, my secretary came back and said, the smile on his face was priceless. She says, John's a good man. And he's also one that he's a bad man. So you just don't want to.
Good or bad, depends on the situation. What is the value? Bad sometimes man. A little of both is good for if you're looking to hire an attorney.
Yeah.
John, I appreciate coming on. We will have to do another one of these episodes where just to share some of the just straight case stories that you have over the years, ones I've heard that I know you have that are just, you've seen it all in the personal injury world. But just to tie it back to our story from the beginning, kind of defining success. So, based on your experience, we have some younger attorneys in our firm. There's obviously some young attorneys listening to this, maybe trying to define their career, how to navigate personal injury, kind of what they should focus on. How would you recommend like a younger attorney define success for themselves in this industry? Like what should they be looking to do? Maybe like what are the intangible factors of how they can grow and get better as a personal injury lawyer?
Well, not everybody's going to have the same life experiences and similar to what I shared with you. So it's kind of a learning process. I think that first I would make sure they ask the question, is this something that I really want to do? And why am I doing this? You know, am I there to make a person's life better that's in, found themselves in a very tragic, unfortunate situation? Am I willing to feel that pain and to being able to bring that case forward? Because if you're able to do that, you'll be successful, but it takes hard work. You know, I'm giving you the emotional piece, but there is a hard work element to it. When I prepare my case, I'll share this. It's the first time I'm actually going to do that. But I think the reason that I've enjoyed the success that I have had is that I prepare the defense's case first to see where my case is vulnerable. Then I do my case to see where I need to address that vulnerability, because my role there is to protect them. It's like a part of your family. If somebody threatens your family to some way harm them, whatever capacity, you're going to do whatever you need to do to protect them. That's the most important element of what you're going to do. And it takes time. You really have to go to those. I strongly recommend going to the seminars, conferences, talking to other lawyers. You know, they're willing to talk to you. If any young lawyer call me, I'd be glad to give them at least my advice and my personal experience as it relates to a certain situation. You know, I teach brain trauma because I had a case that I didn't have an idea about brain trauma, but I reached out to psychologists, neurologists, and educate myself to understanding it to a point where, okay, I could do this in my sleep because I, you know, I've taken the time to do that. It takes a lot of sacrifice and commitment. It takes the same level of drive that that young woman had. And whatever it is that you have, not to quit. But just as important to be trustworthy. Trustworthy to your clients because you've taken on that task, but credible within the industry. So it's really your character that will be evaluated in the end of the day. And when I wake up in the morning and I see that same face, I can honestly say there's nothing that I've done within the practice that I regret or that I felt that I didn't do what was in the best interest of my client. And the day when I'm not doing it anymore, that I can have that same look in the morning, then I think I had a successful career.
That's some incredibly sage advice from John. Not surprised by that at all, based on your experience. John, I want to appreciate again you having joined us today on Injury Pros. You obviously can't wait to have you on again, share some more of your stories. But I just love the way you tied in that story you shared with us and really kind of defining what success means. From all levels. So thanks for joining the Injury Pros. If you want to listen to more episodes, you can go to injurypros.com, follow us on social media, follow our YouTube page for more episodes. And if you need to reach us, or if you want to speak with John, you can go to cortiscosale.com or call our office at Cortisco Sale, 215-642-2335. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.